If you enjoy this podcast, please like us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram and visit our website at lifebetweenthevines.com.
This podcast is sponsored by Release Winery. Join us as the story of this ultra-limited wine continues. Learn more at releasewinery.com.
Look, we can all make wine, Ray. It's not an issue. But can we make a wine that's true to type, that represents that family, that person, their prowess over, you know, 30, 40 vintages? And when I go down to the bunker and I've got 15 years, that's the wine I'm going to be taking.
And it was never the goal to make gobs of money. It was a goal, if you would, a quest to make great wine.
Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle.
And welcome to podcast number 488. This week we feature Charles Desbornais, CEO of Domaine de la Postal, Chile. Seventh-generation winemaker Charles Desbornais is CEO of Domaine de la Postal, a title which he considers to be Chief Entertainment Officer. Indeed, Charles was great fun to chat with during our phone call last week. A French family making wine in Chile is unique, but growing wine with vines over 100 years old, having never experienced phylloxera, that is something else. So listen closely to hear Charles tell the story. You can also hear Charles on our Vino Lingo segment defining the term empanada. On the phone today, we are here with Charles Desbornais of Domaine Desbornais La Postal.
Exactly.
Charles, thanks very much for taking the time. How are you today?
Very good. Here at the winery in Apalta, enjoying the beautiful end of harvest and the autumn finally finishing.
Yeah, you're, again, obviously in the Southern Hemisphere, you are in Chile, and of course you are French, which makes it that much more interesting. What is the weather like right about now for you? Are you more in kind of fall-type weather?
Yeah, it's fall, and you're in spring, so we're in fall, and the weather is beautiful. We have a cool morning, but then it's a very beautiful sunny day today, and we're finishing the harvest, and I think a few more days, and then we'll be done.
Excellent. Glad to hear that. So I guess the first thing I should ask is, how is your 2022 harvest looking?
Exceptional, as usual.
Very good. I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah, we tried last week. We tried last week the 2022, and I think it's really in line with 2021. It was a beautiful vintage. It's still early to say, but the good thing in Chile is that we don't have a vintage swing as they do in Europe, you know. So we're more consistent in the quality of our wines. Yet what we do have, though, is difference between cool years and hot years, depending on the harvest, then you have wines that are more on the elegant side or wines that are more on the fruit side, and that is a bit the aspect of change. So. But the beauty of Chile is that we every year we get to harvest at full maturity, and that is really why every vintage is really exceptional. We don't have bad vintage, and I think, you know, the U.S. is a bit like that too. You know, like we're lucky enough to have enough sun and heat to get to maturity. Then it's different style that can really go into each vintage.
So would you say that's part of the advantage of the mountains and the ocean and simply the way that Chile is laid out?
Well, I think the fact of being, you know, in the Southern Hemisphere helps a lot because, you know, it's we have more sun than in Europe. You know, the fact that one thing that will really influence Chilean wine growing is the ocean and the Andes Mountains, but not so much because of the sun, you know, but because of the control of the maturity. So we're very lucky that the ocean that we share with you, and it's a bit the same thing, is very similar to Sonoma, actually. So we have the ocean that really is cool. You know, we have the Humber Current that comes from Antarctica. So this coolness, this freshness comes from the ocean and inland all the time, and that's why we have cool nights. We have very cool nights, and then we have hot days. So the cool nights, they allow us to have a controlled maturity. So we don't over-mature the grapes. The vines can really relax during the night and then work during the day. So that is really, this is done due to the special geography of Chile. And this freshness and this coolness is stopped by the Andes Mountain. And this is why it's when you look at the difference with Argentina is quite heavy, because Argentina, in Mendoza, they don't have this source of coolness from the ocean. So that's why they have to go in very high altitude to look for freshness. But we don't. Altitude is not an issue in Chile. I always get this question. So how high is your vineyard? I'm like, in Chile, we don't care. You know, the entire country is a coastal country, so it's not an issue for Chilean wines. It's an issue for Argentinian wines.
Very interesting. Very different scenario, and certainly good for grape growing.
Yeah.
I'm going to skip ahead a little bit here to talk about the wine I was sent, which was the, and I'll try and pronounce this correctly, La Parcelle 8?
Yeah.
Am I saying that right?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Perfectly, yeah. So it's a parcel is the smallest division you can have in a vineyard. So when you're in a vineyard, you have first the vineyard, and then you have sectors, and then within sectors you have parcels. And so and then you can go even we do, when we harvest, we go even more in detail within the parcel into how we harvest and so on. But on the wine scale level, when you make a parcel wine, it's really you want to have a wine that has the identity of this unique parcel, this unique little plot. It's a plot. A parcel is a plot.
Sure.
From your vineyard in this place. So it's a really, the more precise wine you can have in a vineyard.
Now, the one thing that really fascinated me was that, and I'm not sure if just strictly this particular parcel of this vineyard or all of yours, that the vineyards are ungrafted, that they haven't been affected by phylloxera, correct?
Yeah. So we are very fortunate, and actually, this is one of the main reasons my family came from France, all the way from France to Chile, and specifically in La Parcelle. So you know, the phylloxera killed all the vines in the world at the end of the 19th century.
Right.
It actually started in the U.S. and made its way to the rest of the world. But Chile was never affected because it's actually protected on all sides by geographical components. But the north of Chile, you have the highest and driest desert in the world, which is the Atacama Desert, and so it's impossible for any pest to go through. Then on the east side, you have the Andes Mountains, which is too high and too cold, so it's another protection. And then on the south, you have Patagonia. In Patagonia, you have all the glaciers and the winds. There is so much wind that the trees are growing sideways. And then finally, on the west, you have the Pacific Ocean. So Chile is almost considered as an island because it's surrounded by natural elements that are protecting it. So the phylloxera could not get into Chile, and so that's why the old vines actually could survive. And we were lucky enough to find in La Parcelle a beautiful vineyard of pre-phylloxeric vineyard, which the vines, and it's composed of 12 parcels, 12 plots. And the plot 8, the parcel 8, is actually the first one that you see when you enter the vineyard. And this is really the one that when my parents entered this vineyard and saw this plot, they fell in love and said, "Oh my God, you know, this is unique in the world." You know, this this is the vision. So that's why we dedicated this wine to the origin of the project of my family.
Excellent. Number one, a very, very fine wine. Thank you very much. I totally enjoyed it. This would be a wine that would be fun to also taste in another 20 years. The one I sampled was a 2015. And if I'm not mistaken, is that a current release for you?
Yeah. We decided that unfortunately, you know, the problem when you make very good wines is that people want to drink them right away.
Yeah.
And it's hard for them to hold on to it. You know, I'm guilty of it myself. You know, I always get a few cases for me at home, and you know, I say, okay, I'm gonna drink a few, and then I'll put a few aside, and then you know, 6 months after, 1 year after, you're like, you know, it was very good, and let's open another one, and then let's open it, and 2 years after, you have nothing in your cellar, so, and you don't enjoy, which is for me is key when you talk about first growth. You need to talk about aging potential and aging wines. You know, this is what a first growth wine should give you. It should give you an immense pleasure right now, but also the ability to age and to evolve. And this is really the evolution that we love and we look forward and we love in wines, you know, the first evolution, second and third. And so we decided for this wine and that to do a bit of a late release, at least for the launch. We'll see if we're able to continue it, because it was such a success that actually we don't have much more now. So but right now we decided to do a late release to give a hint to people of, no, it's an amazing wine now, but you can also age it if you want. But I'm not sure people will do. Yeah, that's the issue. Yeah, we're guilty, you know, and good wines, good friends, you open good bottles. So sure. So it's we're not very patient when it comes to indulging in the pleasure of wines.
No, I understand that. You know, you look in your cellar and today is today. Live for the day. Drink the wine.
But, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
But it certainly occurred to me that, you know, this being a 7-year-old bottle, having it in another 10, 15, 20 years would be, you know, a great comparison.
I mean, at the end of the day, you know, we are very famous in Chile to make wine that age. You know, this is we're a French family. We make wine with a French winemaking technique. And this is what we look for. You know, we look for ageability and acidity and tannins that really can sustain the time. And when you try our Cuvée Alexandre, which is the next level, these days I'm opening my 1999. You know, so this is the, or my 2000. So these are wines that are more than 20 years, and they're perfectly fine. They're beautiful. They're not even in the third evolution. They're still in the second evolution, and we enjoy it so much. So that's why, you know, we're famous for aging wines. Have not to do with where they're from. It has to do with how you made them. You know, and you know, the level of acidity when you harvested, the oak treatment you gave them, and so on. And actually, the U.S. had the same issue in Chile. People said, "Oh, American wines cannot age. Chilean wines cannot age." And it's wrong. They can. Of course they can. If we make them in the way that they will.
You sure.
Know?
Yeah.
Now, of course, not every terroir, not every place will give you this ability, but when you find a place like Apalta, like where we produce Gros Apalta and we produce this wine, there's plenty of wines in Napa and that can actually age, because that's why they're first growth, you know?
Yeah, it's really amazing to think about the age of these vines. I'm going to come back to your particular journey in 1 minute, but how old are these vines? As I understand it, they're the oldest in Chile, but how old are they?
Well, I wouldn't use, you know, like extreme wording, like it's the oldest, because you never really know all the vineyards in
sure.
Chile, and
yeah.
And the mapping is always hard. But they're certainly old, you know, and we estimate they were planted in 1909. Now, you know, as I always say, we don't have pictures, or there was no an Instagram at the time to say, oh, yeah, I remember when we planted them. But so, they, you know, you have to see on traditions, on people, on families, and, you know, and so on. But the estimation of these vineyards in 1909, we have another vineyard that is 1920, another one that is 1940. And this is what is commonly accepted by the SAG, which is the government that tells you, yes, this is what we believe too. So we're talking about vines that are at least 100 years old, and ungrafted, dry farmed. It's really unique in the world.
Totally amazing. Are you doing any replanting at all?
So what do we do? And that's a very interesting point, Ray, because usually when people ask me, so how old is the vineyard? I'm like, well, it was planted in 1909. Now, you can imagine that not all the vines that were planted survive. And so what we do is we do a technique called, in French, it's called marcottage. I don't remember how it's in English. I think it's grounding it's actually, you take one of the shoots of the vine, of the old vines, and you plant it next to it, and so that this shoot is going to create a root system that is going to go up again, and this shoot is going to replace the plant that died next to it. Okay, and so what you ensure is that is the same genetic that is always reproduced, and is the genetics. It's actually a bit Darwinian. Is the survivor of the fittest. So the vines that survived, you take this genetics to actually replant again. So it's very regenerative, if you will, of the vineyard. Now, of course, what does that mean when we talk about the age of the vineyard? Is that we don't have, it's not 1909. They're all not, all the vines are not from 1909. No, maybe it's an old vineyard. And that's why when we talk about vieille, old vineyard, this is what we need to talk about. It's very hard to know exactly how old is the vineyard, because a vineyard is composed by many vines, and each vine is different. But we're talking about a vineyard that was planted 100 years ago and that has survived since then on its own.
Amazing. It's just fascinating to hear about working with these kind of vines.
It's a privilege. It's a privilege, right?
Oh, I can't even imagine. Yeah. Just to look at something that has its own history, it's kind of looking like looking at a redwood, that sort of thing. But your particular journey and your family's journey to come from France to go to Chile to be able to make wine, how did that decision occur? How did that happen?
Well, you know, I think, you know, we're a very old family, per se. So, you know, the Domaine Bornet L'Apostol, L'Apostol as a company, was created in 1827. And it went through three chapters. So the first chapter of L'Apostol was in France, in Nofre-le-Château next to Versailles, and it was actually a distillery. So the winemaking came after. And during three generations, it was Jean-Baptiste, Eugène, and Julia. They were producing spirits in France. And then Julia married a négociant from Sancerre called Alexandre Marnier. And Alexandre Marnier, after marrying Julia L'Apostol, changed its name to Marnier L'Apostol, so that's when the second chapter started. And playing around with the distillery of his father-in-law, he discovered cognac, and he used this cognac to create the Grand Marnier. You know, so the Marnier L'Apostol was the Grand Marnier chapter, if you will, from 1880 to 1994. And so in 1994, my mother, Alexandra Marnier L'Apostol, married Cyril de Bournay. And this is when the Bornet L'Apostol chapter started. So it's the third saga, if you will, the third chapter of the saga. And this is when they were looking. We were already in the wine business because we had Chateau de Sancerre since 1919. So, you know, very old. So we were in the wine and spirits business. But as you know, Sancerre is only white. It's mainly white production. It's Sauvignon Blanc. So we're looking to expand the wine to see, okay, what can we do into the red and to really expand this. And my parents were very intrigued by the fact that Chile never had phylloxera. And so they came in and they visited a few vineyards. And then this is when they stumbled upon Apalpla and they fell in love right away.
Hmm.
And voila, you know.
I can imagine when they got there and discovered this, thinking this is something amazing, completely unique on the planet. This isn't common.
No, it's very interesting because it's always, this is really, when we talk about terroir in France, they always forget the sixth component of terroir, which is the humans. So, of course, terroir is composed by the soil, the exposure, the temperature, the everything. But you always need to bring into equation the humans. These vines have been here since 1909, you know, this vineyard. But the people that owned it didn't realize what they had, what it was, and they were not doing much with it.
Hmm.
So it takes a human to come here to realize that this was a diamond, you know, a brute, you know. And so for these people, they were actually saying, you know, don't worry about the old vines. You know, you can replant with young vines. And we're like, you don't understand. You know, this is a UNESCO patrimony of winemaking. You know, like this is unique. And this is, you know, when you come with a different vision because you understand what these vines can do. And this is why the humans are always part of the terroir, because it's not just about the place, it's about what the connection between nature and humans, and this is what will do a wine. And especially when we talk about grand vins, we say in French, or first growth in English, this is because a first growth should be a reflection from the place where it's from. And this is why it's key. And it was, of course, very emotional to find vineyards like this, you know, especially for French people, because we love them all. You know, phylloxera killed everything.
Yeah, that had to be pretty exciting. What year was the first vintage?
So we started in 1994, and that was L'Apostol. And we took 3 years to understand a bit the lay of the ground, to understand the vines, understand the... And after 3 years, in 1997, we were able to make our first vintage of Croix Apalpla, which is, of course, our iconic wine in Chile. And then since then, we've been able to continue.
It's interesting to me because you kind of have your feet in two different worlds. You're in the old world and you're in the new world. Is that something that reflects in the technology that you work with?
Well, I think being in the old world gave us certainly a way of doing things. You know, like it's so and we're in the luxury, you know, with Grand Marnier, you know, we're reading to the luxury industry with the Chateau de Sancerre. And so, of course, you know, whenever we want to do something in my family, we want to do the best possible. So this is what we want. We're not here to just to make a wine from Chile. We want to make the best wine from Chile and a wine that can compete with the best one in the world. That was the goal. It was not just to do another wine to bring in a market. So this mentality and this knowledge of vineyards and understanding the winemaking, how you should do it, the long-term thinking in vineyards, is I think, certainly something that is that we get from friends. Now, the good thing when we come to Chile is that everything is new. So you're not limited by the old techniques because you can actually shatter the things and say, well, you know, we could do this in another way. We can actually bring new technology right away. We don't have to wait. We don't have to do things. And of course, for me, the worst sentence is, we've always done it this way, so let's continue. No, you know, now we have, what's important is that you do the thing, you do everything in the same mentality, in the same vision, in the same goal to do the best, but not in the same way. You have to adapt. It's a different country, it's a different terroir, it's a different place, and but with the same vision. So yeah, it's fun. It's quite fun.
I'll bet. I'm a little jealous, I have to say. A lot of hard work, though, too.
Oh, yeah. Well,
as CEO, obviously, it's a great deal that falls on your shoulders. But as you came into the industry, was this something predetermined that you would, simply because of the heritage of the family, be in the wine business? Or did you consider a different direction when you were younger?
Well, so it's actually interesting because then here we're talking about family business governance. But I'm the seventh generation. I'm part of the seventh generation of the family. As you can imagine, we're quite a few after seven generations, and then you know this is just family governance of my generation. I'm actually the only one working in it because we have specific rules. It's not nepotism is good, but to a certain extent, and you have to control it. So so I was lucky enough that that of course you know when you have a family business you're vested in it, you want to be part of it because it's especially when it has your name on it, you know, Grand Marnier, L'Apostole, and so on. But at the end of the day, you need to have strict rules if you want to get to the eighth and ninth generation, you know. And so for me, I was lucky enough to that things got in a good way that now I'm here in charge of it. As you said, I'm happy. I have a few shoulders. I have the weight of 200 years old on my shoulders. So I don't want to be the generation that messed it up. That's going to mess it up. So it's a bit of pressure, you know. But you get used to it.
You have this past that you're responsible for, but the other side of that is, you are going to have people in the future that will be looking back at you saying, well, yeah, what decisions was he making? How did he do things? That's also a great responsibility.
Yeah. No. Of course. Of course, you know, that's why I say, you know, you don't want to be the one that says, well, we had a good run until Charles.
You know? You don't want that.
But then, you know, it's you get used to it, and then you know, I'm very fortunate because I have amazing examples from the past generations, and also I have an amazing team that works with me. I'm not alone, of course, and we're a team.
Sure.
I'm merely, you know, like, and at the end of the day, you know, it takes really a village to make this work, and I'm surrounded by amazing people, and that's really. And we are lucky enough because, you know, some of them were hired by my parents, some of them I hired myself. But then, you know, you have a mix of continuity, and so you know, you pass along what you know, the experience, and my parents were amazing to be kind enough to leave me be myself and do my mistakes and do my vision and to understand that even if they had a lot of success and amazing success, well, I'm different than they are, and it doesn't mean that I'm going to do things differently because I'm a different person, and it doesn't mean that it's not going to be successful. It's just going to be my own way of doing things, and it has to be this way because if I try to do the same thing as they did, well, I'm not them, so I potentially will not work because it won't be done naturally. But that's we studied this a lot in family businesses to not, you know, like it's hard for all generations, but it's for me it has really worked well.
That's great. Excellent. Well, and I'm sure things will continue on quite well. But it kind of brings me to my next question, and that is there one particular lesson you've learned, one particular thing you live by that is so very important to how you operate now and into the future?
you know, one thing you learn quickly when you when you're into the wine industry is when you plant a vineyard, it's going to be here for a long time, and so the choices you make today are going to. It's not just a 5-year plan. That's a 30 years, 40 years. If you're lucky enough, 100 years plan. Okay, because then this is you're planting a vineyard, and so you need to think ahead, and you need to be also humbled by the fact that right now we have vineyards that were planted 30 years ago by different generations, and it is thanks to them that we have this amazing vineyard now, and we can make amazing wine. So I think the very long-term thinking approach. And humble approach, because you don't know what's going to be happening in 30 years. You know, who would have thought the global climate will be going this way, and so on. So, of course, vines are changing. It's hotter. Maybe the Merlot is not sustaining the heat as it used to be. So what are we going to plant to replace the Merlot? Is this going to be working in 30 years? Because maybe it will be hotter, but with more rain. I don't know. I'm just shooting up things like this. But so long-term vision, humility, and not thinking you know it all, because nature will have a way to humble you very quickly.
Yeah. Well, there is such a thing as overthinking. That's something we humans are quite good at doing. You mentioned climate change, which is obviously a big deal. And since you have this wonderful little heaven of these ungrafted vines, what is your concern as you stand now and looking into your crystal ball for, say, the next 10 years as a winery?
What we think is going to 10 years, we're thinking 20 years ahead. So right now we're planting, for instance, a vineyard. We're replanting a vineyard that we groped up 5 years ago. And now, so it's been all the process of, you know, what are we going to plant? And we're thinking in 2040, 2050, and so on. Because usually when you plant a vineyard, it's 30 years. But for us, we want to go even further. And that's why, you know, we have this sustainability approach of the vineyard. We know we can go because we have vineyards that are older, that are, you know, 80 years, 100 years. So that's the point. That's where you want to be able to go. So not to grow it up in 30 years and to replant again because you extracted everything and there's not much to do. So that's not the vision we have. So we've been thinking quite a big deal. And, of course, something that has been going in Chile and it's going also in California and so on is the drought. So we've been in a severe drought for the past 10 years.
Yikes.
So lack of water, there is less and less water. There is more and more every year. It's getting hotter and hotter. Now you know it's always complex because everyone always says global warming, but for me it's really climate change because when it's hot it's getting hotter, but when it's cold it's getting cooler.
Sure.
Usually in Chile, Chile was what we call the winter only rain pattern, so it will only rain in winter, and now it's starting to rain in April, and now it's for the first time in 2016 we had to deal with rain during harvest. Last week, it poured rain. It was almost tropical rain in Chile. Never happened in 100 years at the end of April to have that much rain in 3 or 4 days. So I think this is why, for me, climate change is more correct, because even if we are, heating up and at a faster rate, it also creates a completely different climates and so on. So it's hard to do. I think Chile will be going the hotter way. So where we are, it will be hotter. So that's why we're trying to plant grapes that will sustain heat in a better way and drought. And then we will have to see, you know, what happens.
Sure. The only way to learn is from the experience.
Yeah.
You know, as a professional winemaker, and for those of us in the business who simply love wine, you know, our goal for the podcast is making wine less scary. And I'm sure to a great degree it's the same for you. How do you deal with that when you're talking to people? Obviously, you taste with a very broad group of people. But when you have somebody who you can sort of see the fear in their eyes, they don't want to look stupid. They want to understand how to taste, what to taste. But more so, how do you just get them to feel comfortable?
It's actually very good objective. And it's one of my – I want – in a way to dumb wine down so that people are not afraid and say, well, you know what? I don't understand much about wine, so your wines are too. And this is usually an issue we have with La Postole, especially in Chile, where people say, oh, La Postole, it's too complex for me. It's too big of a wine for me, so I drink other wines. And I'm like, this is ridiculous. You know, I'm like, how much are you spending for your wine? And like, $15. Well, we do have wines at $15, you know,
sure.
But but we're seen as so wine that are really for very savvy people. And so for me, I try to dumb it down and say, guys, first, there is no issue if you don't like a wine. It doesn't matter if you pay $100, $200, you know, like, it doesn't matter. There are wines that are $15 that are amazing and ones that are $200 that are really not drinkable. So at the end of the day, what it depends is trust your instinct, trust what you like, and learn what are your tastes. Some people like white wine, some people like, you know, red wine, some people like fruity wine, some people like more on the elegant side. And I always, some people tell me, you know what, I love your Carmenere, but I don't really like your Sauvignon Blanc. I'm like, well, what's the issue? You know, let's go to the store and find a Sauvignon Blanc from one of my fellow winemakers that you will like, because that's why there are so many wines in the markets. So for me, what I'm trying to always tell them is, don't be shy of your taste, because I'm always surprised that when it comes to winemaking or to wine, people actually are like, the wine is winning. You see what I mean? Like, the wine,
sure.
It's the wine is good. Their taste is wrong, and I'm like, it's the opposite. The wine is not wrong. Your taste is not wrong. It's just that this is not your taste, and you need to understand your taste, and then you need to buy wines that are in this taste, and that's it. So but it's very interesting, as you said, that when it comes to wine, people think it's too complex, they don't understand it, and then they start feeling bad. I'm like, don't feel bad about your taste.
Right.
You know, and own it and say, I like these wines, you know, full bodied, good for you. Well, let's find full bodied wines that you love and stick to it.
Sure.
So, yeah, but it's a hard conversation usually, because, you know, people say, oh, it's too complex, I drink beer or whatever. I'm like, well, I drink both, you know.
Right.
I drink beer, I drink cocktails, I drink wine, I drink whatever I like. But don't underestimate your taste.
That's right.
Yours is yours, and there's nothing wrong about it.
Right. Variety is what it's all about.
Yeah, and there's enough wines in the world, you know, to find one that you're going to like.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Anybody who's stood in a wine store for any length of time, their brain explodes after a few minutes.
But you know what? Something that I'd like to say here is that I think the way we retail wines is wrong. And I was talking about a store in Netherlands that actually changed the way they retail wine. And instead of doing it by origins, by blah, 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 they're doing it by taste profile.
Mm.
And I think this is the future, because people don't understand, you know, like if you say, oh, Chile. Well, you know, in Chile, there are wines that are very different from different places. So California, too, and France, too, you know. So what's important, I think, at the end of the day, is the taste profile. And I think the way we market the wines, we retail the wine, should it be in retail or in a wine list, always talking about, oh, you know, it's Pauillac or it's a Napa Valley. Oh, well, you know, people say, oh, I love Napa. Oh, I hate Napa. I'm like, well, you know, it's a bit strong. I'm sure that if you go, you will find ones that you love and you will find ones that you don't like. But at the end of the day, I think we should talk about the flavor profile, the profile of the wine, instead of you know, like putting this wine list or these stores by origin, because it's unfair. In the same origin, you have different styles. And I think we'll make it better for the world if we start talking about the profile of the wine instead of where it's from.
I completely agree. And you're not the first person I've heard that from. I did hear that from one other winemaker earlier this year, and it fascinates me. You're right. Retailing can be its own, it's a deck of cards you're blind to. You don't really know. Of course, the one nice thing is you could take a picture of the label and remember it and buy it again after the bottle's gone away. So,
no, of course.
There you go.
And you know, when it comes, and I think this is specifically true for New World, because in France, because there are so many rules in the AOC system, you know, the denomination of origin.
Sure.
Then talking about origins can lead to a certain taste profile, because if you are, let's say, if we are, you know, different winemakers from Bordeaux, but let's say from Pauillac, they are in the same place, they have the same soil, and they have to abide by the same rules. So this is why in Europe it works to talk about origins. But when it comes to the New World, it doesn't, because we don't have any rules. You know, a producer in Napa does whatever he wants compared to his neighbor. And that means that there is no taste profile by the origin. It's a taste profile by winemakers. And so what works for the, you know, it goes back to our conversation before, what works for the old world doesn't really necessarily work for the new world. And this is where we need to take a stand and say, well, stop, in the new world, there's no sense of putting the origin of the wines or listing the wines by origin. We should list the wines by the taste profile.
Sure. Being more sensitive to your buyers more than anything else.
Of course.
Letting them understand and learn, not live in fear.
They're the one buying. Make it easy for them, you know?
You want to make it real easy. Well, this is my favorite question to ask all winemakers. You know, you've obviously been doing this for some time and you've done plenty of media. But what's the one question that you've never been asked that you would like to be asked?
Well, that's interesting because I've been asked really all sort of questions in my small career. Yeah, well, these two questions they always ask me because, you did ask it to me, because I'm part of a family, so they always ask me, was that predetermined or is that your own choice? It's a bit more complex, as you say, it's a bit of destiny in it. An interesting question is do I want my children, or I have a daughter, to continue this path? That's an interesting question. Because I'm the seven. We always talk about the past, but never, no one really asked me. So, and they take for granted that you want your children to follow you. But family business is complex. Winemaking is its own life to it. And no one really asked me about the future generations. They always ask me about the past generations.
Well, let me ask you that question.
Well, I have a beautiful daughter. She's only 11 months. She's quite young. and I think as every parent, you want to say, I'm doing this every time I'm thinking of her, saying, I want to give her in 20 years, 30 years, I want to be able to give her something beautiful. It's a beautiful place. I truly believe that we are, as winemakers, we have a special link to places where we produce wine because at the end of the day, we know every place of it, every little corner, every vine. And so there's a very emotional place. But you have to let it grow, And of course, for me, I hope she will continue because we're certainly thinking every time we're planting, okay, this Alisa is going to be harvesting this one in 30 years, going to be making wines and so on. But, at the end of the day, you have to let them do it, If she has the passion, she will get into it, and if she has something else, she will, But hopefully, she will always have a link with winemaking. Yes, because it's something that brings you a lot of humility in life, as I said, because you depend on nature, you don't control everything, so you have to be very humble, and then it's always good to have a link with this world.
Sure. Sure. Well, a vineyard is a bit of a time machine.
It is.
And I certainly hope that it goes the way you want it to go. Most importantly, Charles, for our listeners who would like to learn about you, your wines, and the history of the winery and your family, what is your website?
So you have two websites. We have the www.closapalta.com and the lapostol.com.
Great. Excellent. This has been a lot of fun talking to you. I love hearing your passion, especially, my gosh, coming upon these vineyards just must have been amazing. Thank you for taking the time. I really do appreciate it.
No, thank you, Ray, for having me. I hope one day you'll come and visit.
Learn more by visiting lapostolwines.com. Thanks for listening. Subscribe to the podcast at lifebetweenthevines.com or sign up to our YouTube channel. You can also follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Life Between the Vines comes to you from Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Our host is Kay Paskoff. Our web geek is Dan Gieschen. Original music by Ray Pfister. Copyright 2022.